In our Olympic history journey as we head towards the Paris Olympics, which kick off in late July this year, we finally arrived in Australia in time for the 1956 Olympic Games, which were, of course, held in Melbourne. You might have some memories about it. You might even like to give me a call, 1300 800 222 or SMS in 0467 922 702. Professor Richard Cashman is back with you now, sports historian at the School of Business at the University of Technology in Sydney. Hi, Richard.
Hello, Suzanne.
It's exciting for us to finally be on home soil. And in 1956, this is the first time the Games had been held outside Europe or America. What was the bidding process like for Melbourne to get the Games?
There was a bid from Buenos Aires. There was a bid from a number of American cities. There was a bid from Mexico City. But the final vote in 1949 was that Melbourne defeated Buenos Aires by 22 to 20, by one vote.
One vote, so we just squeezed in there. I'd imagine there must have been, at the time, a push to say, look, we've been having it in Europe, we've been having it in America, let's try to make it more global.
Yes, but the IOC was very Eurocentric in its early days. They went to Europe many times. They went to USA. The third time they should have gone to Asia, because that's where the big global populations were. Tokyo won the bid for 1940, but of course those games were not held. But the first games in Asia was not till 1964. So it's really ironic that a small continent of Australia, well, it's wonderful for us. Actually, it was the third to be honoured with the games.
Yeah, exactly so. But yes, in terms of population, probably should have gone to Asia. So now here's a piece of history I didn't know, that I imagine that everyone got on board and this was all done quite seamlessly. But in fact, it was a bit of a shambles as the organisers in Melbourne were trying to get everything done, ready for the Games. At one point, the IOC even had to threaten to take the Games away.
Yes, there was a lot of political infighting and indecisiveness, because they had six different possible venues for the main stadium, including Prince's Park in Carlton and the showgrounds, and before they finally decided on the MCG, which is a logical place to have the games. It all came to a fore when Avery Brundage came to Melbourne 18 minutes before the games and said, look, you're not making much progress. There's a lot of other cities who'd like to have the games. If you don't get a move on, you'll lose the games. And that galvanised action, and the Victorian government and the Commonwealth government became very involved.
And so that's why they decided, didn't they, that the MCG was going to be the main focus for the games.
And it was all forgotten. When the games opened on the 22nd of November, there was a lovely day. I remember seeing it, 103,000 spectators, and it all went wonderfully well. So they had an excellent opening ceremony, and they could forget about all the trauma of getting there.
We talked last week, Richard, about the Soviet Union joining the Olympics in Helsinki in 1952, and the Soviets were back again, and we saw a more continuation of these Cold War rivalries playing out on the medal table.
It's quite surprising that the USSR topped the medal table by a wide margin. 98 medals, USA only got 74. So USSR got 37 gold, 29 silver and 32 bronze. USA 32 gold, 25 and 17 bronze.
Did that create a lot of resentment with people saying, well, this is just another example of, you know, state-sponsored athleticism?
There was an element of that, but there was one Soviet athlete, Vladimir Kuts, who won the 5,000 and 10,000 metres races, and he was an outgoing person and very popular with Australian audiences. So he went against the stereotype of grey Soviet athletes, and after the games he went and had a swim at Bondi. Although he was an officer in the Soviet Army and a member of the Communist Party, but he was very popular. So I guess the audience accepted that it brought competition between the two big powers. And it was offset because Australia did so well. Australia came third.
Yes, I mean, and so this is the best. I think we did sixth in Helsinki, you were telling us. So this is third. How many gold, silver, bronze?
Amazing. 13 gold, 8 silver and 14 bronze. So it was a golden games for Australia.
Now, much of that was due to our success in the pool particularly, wasn't it?
Yes, 8 of the medals were in the pool and Australia dominated the pool and America...
So that's eight gold, in
eight
fact.
8 gold. America only got 2 gold. And what is very interesting, in freestyle, in the 100 metres, men's and women, Australians finished first, second and third. That's kind of unprecedented. In the freestyle, they were extremely strong.
Now, Japan also did well. So it was Australia, USA and then Japan, who we've mentioned had popped up in 1932. And so they're sort of back as a swimming force at these games.
Not as a force, as a swimming nation. They got 1 gold and 4 silver. There was a swimmer, Yamanaka. He and Murray Rose had very close contests. But, yeah, the USA was a second dominant country in the pool.
Yeah, but Japan certainly making a showing. And Richard, is this really the 56 games where we saw Australia for the first time really, I guess, hammer home that domination in the pool and put itself forward as a nation that always does well in the pool?
Yes, and we're in the top 3 swimming nations in Olympic results, which is amazing given our population. And I think now we're second.
So this is a stat that just week after week, Richard, we keep hearing that there's a much smaller proportion of women on the team, although we're up to 44 women this time, and I think we had much less at the previous 2 Olympics. But they're doing, you know, really well when it comes to collecting those gold medals.
There were only 44 women compared with 270 men in the Australian team, but they achieved 7 gold medals. The men got 6.
So who are the stars of the team?
Well, there were some great stars at the 1956 Olympics. Who can forget Betty Cuthbert, winner of 3 gold medals? She had a high action with her knee and she ran to the tape with her arm, with her mouth wide open. And then there was Murray Rose, who was actually born in Britain, and he won 3 golds, the 400 metres, 1500 metres and the 4x200 metres relay. And then Dawn Fraser began her illustrious career, winning a gold in the 100 metres in the relay and silver in the 400. And she had close tussles with Lorraine Crapp. She only just beat Lorraine Crapp in the 100 metres and Lorraine Crapp won the 400 metres. But Dawn Fraser became an Australian much loved. She was from Balmain. She was the 8th child in a family. And she was a bit of a scrapper and even a bit of a larrikin at times. But she's much loved by the Australian public. And this was the beginning of a stellar career.
Yeah, and I think we'll have more to say about some of her more controversial antics a bit further down the line in a later Olympics. So, look, you said we had Vladimir Kuts, who was the Soviet athlete who was very gregarious and everyone sort of went, yeah, this is nice, even though we were a bit worried that the Soviets might be all faceless athletes. But when it came to water polo and the USSR playing Hungary, there was literally blood in the water.
Yes, because just before the Games, there was a Hungarian uprising or revolution in October and the Soviets crushed it shortly thereafter. And the relationships between the two teams were very tense and a number of Hungarian athletes or some Hungarian athletes defected to Australia after the Games.
And so when there was blood in the water, what, someone got hit, did they, by a, what actually happened?
Oh, underwater in water polo, you can get away with things, bashing people and kicking them and doing all sorts of things. I'm not quite sure, but there was a lot going on. And presumably they didn't have as much videotapes of all the things to give people yellow cards or red cards or things like that. But it was a very vicious final.
And there was another innovation in the Games at the closing ceremony, a very lovely one. Tell us about it.
A young Chinese-Australian, 17-year-old John Ian Wing, wrote to the organising committee and said in the closing ceremony, all the athletes should march as individuals, as part of one team. they should abandon their own teams. And he even sent a diagram of how it might look. That was adopted in 1956 and has been adopted every game since. And John Ian Wing came to the Sydney Olympic Games and was honoured for his innovation.
Now, we had a question about this in our history quiz a couple of weeks ago, actually, Richard, and that's about the fact that Stockholm hosted the equestrian events for the Melbourne Olympics. Why did they do this?
Because of the strict quarantine laws, horses could not be brought to Australia in that era. We got over that.
None at all?
No. There was problems, quarantine issues. So the strange thing was the games were held between the 10th and 17th of June, about 5 months before the official games.
So these are the equestrian events in Stockholm?
The equestrian events were held there. Australia sent a team but was unplaced in any events. I don't know the reason why it was Stockholm rather than Helsinki. I'll see if I can find out.
Okay, because we did have a question from Michael from Inglewood who did want to know. He was saying, well, look, Helsinki held the 52 games, so surely they had the facilities up and running. But, Richard, what happened to our team? Did they send their horses overseas and bring them back home, or did they have to go and ride on other people's horses?
I assume they had to ride another. Sweden didn't have quarantine laws, but it would have been a problem if they took their own horses of coming back into Australia. They would have had problems. So I assume they rode on other horses, but I don't know. That's a very good question.
All right, why don't we pop that on the list to find out as well. I've got Professor Richard Cashman with me, sports historian at the Business School at the University of Technology in Sydney. So could Australians watch the games on television at all? I mean, television's very, very new at this point, or how are they, you know, finding out what was going on?
The games helped to sell television sets. Sport always is the great seller of television sets, whatever the sport.
That's right, or it forces you to sign up to some streaming service that you didn't want.
Yes. Yeah. You could only watch the games live in a limited area in Victoria. The coaxial cable was laid between Sydney and Melbourne in 1961, and only after 61 could you have live coverage of an event in Melbourne. A national hookup did not occur till the 1970s. So what happened, and I remember this myself, because my uncle had a television, we didn't have one at this stage. The event was filmed and the films were flown up to Sydney by TAA, and then you had a delayed telecast on channel TCN9, I think it was. Mm-hmm.
So how old were you, Richard? I mean, you don't have to give away your age, but you're a young tacker, were you?
I was a youth at that stage.
And was this, how excited were you by these Olympics? I mean, it's become your passion. Was that evident to you at this age when you watched the 56 games?
Yes, I was very excited by it. Well, everyone was excited by the games, and I guess I was not old enough to go down to Melbourne. That would have been a lovely thing because I was very involved in the Sydney Games.
Now, and this, as you say too, was really the start of an ongoing love affair with the Olympics in Australia.
Yes, it ushered in what was a golden era of Australian sport. People loved that era, very nostalgic about that. And I think it was one reason why Sydney bid for the Games in 2000 is that they wanted to have this golden glow. So the Olympic Committee gave a lot of money and tried to make sure that we did win a lot of medals, which we did. But it made everyone feel good about themselves.
And there'll be another era of people who remember the golden glow of Sydney who want to recreate that as well. And yes, that's probably partly why Brisbane's bid for the Games.
Yes, although it seems a bit harder to generate that golden feeling these days. It wasn't a problem in Sydney because their government was quite prepared to spend money on all sorts of new facilities, but there's some problem issues with Brisbane.
Yeah, I know. Sydney, they even made the public transport run on time.
Yes.
That was a commitment.
And they made good weather, apart from rain, a little bit of rain.
And Richard, you say these Melbourne Games of 56 were the last of the innocent games. What do you mean by that?
One of the last of the innocent games. In the 60s and 70s, other issues emerged. Drugs, systemic doping of the GDR team, terrorism, which we'll talk about at Munich. So all these other issues emerged. And this was largely the happy sort of game, with some edginess.
Yes, thanks to the blood in the water and that water polo match. Richard, thank you for taking us back to 1956.
Thank you.
Professor Richard Cashman is a sports historian at the School of Business based at Sydney's University of Technology.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.